When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing and context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
A change of seasons means adventures in rain, shine, mist, or snow, or all of the above on the same day. This season, prepare for every season with the Allbirds Mizzle Collection. With all-condition traction and materials and features to keep you comfy and dry no matter what, you'll be ready for anything. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with your purchase. ALLBIRDS.com, code FRESHSOCKS.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel, the editor of the TLS. Thea has snuck away to improve her language skills even more. So this week, I'm joined by indie pop star Lucy Dallas, who, and this will become relevant, is not a millennial or a witch, but is a mother. Hello, Lucy.
Hello.
Is that a fair description?
Well, obviously I'm not a millennial because I'm far too young. That
or old,
one or the other.
Yeah.
I am a mother.
Yes,
I may well be a witch, but I am certainly not letting on under these circumstances. So that's as far as I will go.
All right. Well, we shall see. You'll see its relevance shortly. We're just coming to the end of the TLS spring sale at the moment, but you have a couple more days to get an outrageously cheap subscription. Google it and tuck in. But coming up on this week's show, why do we hold mothers and motherhood in such ambivalence, both as an idealised state and somehow responsible for all the world's ills? Ruth Skirr will join us for this Freudian nightmare. We extracted a bit of Madeline Miller's book Circe a couple of weeks ago in the TLS. Lucy Dallas sat down with Madeline in the TLS office this week to discuss making hits from myths. And millennials. You can't live with them and you're not allowed to throw avocados at them. Samuel Earle has reviewed a fascinating book on this fascinating social phenomenon and he'll be in the studio. Did you know that I was a millennial, Lucy?
I did.
By some reckoning.
I did in fact know that, yeah.
Because
yeah,
I believe millennials are born in the 1980s.
Yeah, but do you think you qualify really?
No, I obviously don't. Matt, our producer, was born in 1981. He's not a millennial. You're not a millennial.
I'm not
by
a millennial,
definition.
No.
By no stretch of
all right,
that term.
All right.
I'm not a millennial, no.
So we can discuss them dispassionately.
Should we try and do that?
Yeah, but okay. With compassion.
Deal. It's not especially new, the idea that the youth are misunderstood and maligned, or that they have a set of values and expectations different to those of their parents. The notion of a generational clash, as Samuel Earle puts it this week, has been around for generations. But with millennials, those born somewhere in the 80s and 90s, there does seem to be something for them to clash about. Here's a British statistic for you that I mentioned in my book. A 30-year-old today is worth 21% less than in 1983. A 60-year-old is worth twice as much. Prospects for young people today are not especially rosy. As Sam puts it, longer school hours, more protective parenting, more competition, less playtime, proliferating debt, wages are weaker, careers more precarious, and wealth inequality soars. Yes, you might say, but of avocado on toast is delicious. Sam has reviewed Malcolm Harris's Kids These Days, which makes no mention of avocados, and joins Lucy and me in the studio now. Sam, hello.
Hiya.
So, millennials, should they be paranoid, or are they the most overanalyzed generation ever?
Well, we're certainly the most, and I say we as a millennial myself.
You are a proper. See, yes. I'm a pseudo millennial. So I was born in 1980. Lucy, whose age you won't disclose, is definitely not a millennial.
It's been going on at me. I am far too old.
Far too old for a millennial.
That's fine.
What was your birthday?
29th of August, 1992.
So you're a real, almost a late millennial.
In the zone.
Yeah.
Okay. So as a millennial yourself, are you overanalyzed?
Well, we certainly are overanalyzed and overburdened with problems that are affecting society as a whole. And I think, in a sense, obviously millennials do receive a lot of attention, a lot of critical attention.
Do you feel that as a millennial? Do you feel that when you open... Because newspapers are also written by 50-year-old men.
Completely.
Generally.
My response, and the response of most of, I think, my generation is largely to laugh, because it is blaming millennials for structural problems. And so there's a kind of endless, kind of barrage of, as you mentioned, like millennials spending too much on frivolous things. Millennials aren't having enough sex. Millennials aren't...
it's true. One in six people don't lose their virginity until the age of 26 now.
What on earth? How could that be the business of... any other generation, let alone the older generation.
They live in a hyper-sexualized world. They grow up in a world of shareable pornography. So millennials have grown up as adolescents, some of them, for the first time ever, where pornography, particularly for young men, has been very, very accessible in a way that it wasn't, say, for me when I grew up. And that's changed their perspective on sex. And so... there's an argument they are more reluctant to have sex because of the grotesque expectations that now exist around it.
I think that's what makes talking about millennials so difficult, is that there's been such a wide number of new trends that have emerged over the last 20 years. We can talk about kind of pornography becoming more common and easily accessible, but there's also new forms of communication and socializing that encourages or that it's more suited to staying separated. And I remember when I was young, we had MSN, and you'd talk to your friends from school, and that would kind of be the highlight of your evening. But that's now become far more common.
You're connected all the time. I think it feels really keenly that the first time in human history that when you shut the door, you can't keep the world out.
Yeah, well, you can keep the world out, but the world can stay on. You can turn it off.
You can, but it's very hard to turn it off.
I know, but...
I imagine when you're growing up with MSN, but now if you're growing up with Facebook or Snapchat and you're not there because your mum says don't do it...
Yeah.
It's very hard to do that.
And this also feeds into this... We can never essentially blame millennials for... let's say the fact that they're more likely to talk more openly on the internet than face to face, or that they are increasingly drawn to their mobile phones rather than the real world. Because the other important thing is that these technologies, which so saturate everyone's life, but especially millennials, are designed in a way that's meant to be addictive.
Yes.
And
yeah.
Encourages more and more use. And to blame millennials for essentially being, hooked on them, as though it's something innate to our personalities, misses the mark on essentially what makes a lot of these technologies tick, rather than millennials themselves.
Yeah, I think there's two things, aren't there? There's one is that you can analyse a generation, I mean, which may or may not be annoying to the generation, but then it moves very quickly into blame. Mm. And I think the older generation has got no business turning around and saying, well, why are you doing this? Because as Sam says, a lot of it is structural.
But the devil's advocate argument would be, 30 or 40 years ago, there were freedoms that didn't exist for people. Yeah. The people who are of a younger generation do enjoy, ability to... And the reason why I think people get hung up on avocado on toast and coffees is that 50 years ago, people very often had less disposable income. Income was more bound up in a different way, it seems to me. There wasn't so much of an ability for a 20-year-old to go out for dinner as often. We live in a much more consumable culture, don't we, Sam? And that presumably, that's where I think a lot of this angst comes from, because people say, if you're moaning so much about not having any money, how come I can see you buying a coffee? When I was a kid, we didn't go out for coffee. So it looks like you're being frivolous.
I think what a lot of people have trouble accepting or thinking is that the world becomes better and worse at the same time. Yeah. And there have been huge improvements, and I don't think anyone wants to turn back the clock and go back to the 60s or 70s or kind of whatever. But what we do want is to look back at some of the advantages that you enjoyed and hopefully be able to combine them with the advantages that we have. Because especially, you know, one thing that millennials and in general younger people have is very common is a much more progressive views on, let's say, on sexuality, yeah. kind of, you know, on politics of race, of sex. And we can see firsthand the advances that have been made in those respects. But it's just a shame that those advances have also kind of run along next to work becoming far more precarious and debt becoming so much more common. Of course, and again, you know, university has become, you know, more kind of universal in its scope, and kids are getting to go to university who never would have had the opportunity before. But one of the things that all students now graduate with is a huge amount of debt, which, and I also don't think we can underestimate the shadow that debt kind of casts on the future and makes you anxious in your day-to-day life.
And things like housing seems to me to be the classic one. I talked to my parents about this, who are classic baby boomers, I think, and, you know, they could buy a house. People could buy houses for 10 grand. And they were earning 3 grand a year. Mm-hmm. And so their house was three times their salary. Now, if a person earns 30 grand a year, which is better than average, they ain't going to get a house for 90 grand.
No.
Mm. And in London, that's certainly not the case.
Yeah.
So there's been a divorce, a fundamental economic divorce between things that were verities, were things that our parents' generation could guarantee themselves. That is not available to you, Sam. That's never. You're never going to afford a house three times your salary. It's going to be very hard, isn't it? Not just you, but just generally.
Of course, the average
person is going to struggle.
The maths isn't the same. The numbers aren't the
same. The numbers don't work, do they?
Yeah, no, the multipliers.
And with that, though, brings debt.
Yeah.
And your generation is expected to say, we can live with debt.
Yeah.
And do you feel that maybe you don't want to? Maybe you don't want to.
And I think one of the great ironies of the current government, and which has been the case for the past 10 years, is them saying on the state level how important it is that Britain must live within its means and get rid of all debt, while the consequence of that has been burdening students with so much debt. And that mixed message of debt is bad and debt is necessary is, I don't know, it kind of...
It's also a bit of a kind of guinea pig generation, because you've been saddled with that debt for the first time. And as you say, with the technology thing, and I completely agree about the things like the stuff on Facebook and Twitter and all that stuff was explicitly designed to be addictive. And now you're getting quite a lot of the people, a reasonable percentage of the people who designed it, are now coming out and saying, actually, this is working far too well. We didn't want it. We didn't really want it to kind of take over the world. But you're very much, there isn't a model for how to behave with that. Somebody gives you something addictive, you get addicted.
Is there a backlash though? I wonder whether, do you think that by the time this generation is 40, they will be living in homes which have no internet access, or the smartphone will be abandoned in favour of an old-fashioned phone that simply receives calls, or because something is going to have to change. There's a great internet scandal. Did you see this? Not scandal, but furore about doorbells. Are you aware of this?
Yes.
Someone just tweeted, I never use a doorbell.
Yeah.
I don't use doorbells. I find that, and if someone rings my door, I don't answer if they ring the doorbell, because my friends only communicate via their smartphone.
Right.
And doorbells are basically completely anathema to a certain generation. Do you feel that, by the way, Sam? Are you terrified of the doorbell?
I'm not. No, I don't actually share that aspect.
But it's a thing. And so, are we going to have to? Do you think there'll be a backlash where a sort of anti-technology takes over?
I don't think that is what will happen. I think, and I don't think it's ever kind of helpful to completely reverse something's happened. And like I said, things get better and worse at the same time. There are advantages from having these technologies, which we cherish and which we love. And like Twitter, you know, has got some very kind of hilarious sides to it. And the way in which we kind of engage and interact with each other through the like memes and those kind of concise tweets has in a way brought like a new element of like language, I think, to our lives and of humor, which I would not want to lose. It's about having conversations about how we can make these technologies work for us more rather than having to switch off them completely.
You review Malcolm Harris's book, yeah. Kids These Days. Does he have any solutions? From the review, it sounds like he was very good at analysing all of the problems we've just talked about, and then it got to the bit, and now the solution is, and there was a sort of embarrassed cough.
He describes himself in his author's bio as, I think, a revolutionary anarchist. Okay. So he has a... I'm afraid the solution is society must be turned on its head. And
that's quite an old-fashioned solution. Yeah.
Well, there was 1968, isn't it? There is a line in it where he says, which I mentioned in the review, either we become fascists or revolutionaries, one or the other. And reading it kind of in 2018, it did have a bit of a quaint kind of ring to it. Mm.
So he doesn't have a solution then, basically. That's no solution,
yeah,
is it?
Well, I think one thing he is right about is that it isn't easy to come up with a kind of like surface solutions to this problem. And I think it also isn't helpful to see it as a young versus old divide, really, which is what you see a lot on the front pages of newspapers and magazines, is young versus old, millennials versus baby boomers.
It isn't because there's
a lot of, over 65s who are not in an envious position, who millennials would not want to swap places with, or inequality doesn't work as simple as young versus old.
Mm. It doesn't, although if you have been alive for the last 40 years and you bought a property in the 1960s and 1970s, you are far more asset rich than people of a younger generation. And actually, if you do look at the division, I mean, you're absolutely right. There are lots of people who are older who have terrible conditions. But actually, the number of pensioners in relative poverty has fallen in the last 10 years because they have triple lock pensions that have gone above inflation, and they have properties which have accrued massively in value. Neither of those things are going to be open to millennials. So there is something, I mean, you're right, it can be, but you think it's unhelpful to see it as a battle of the generations.
I really don't think it's helpful to see it as a battle of generations. I think that in a sense, millennials and old people suffer in a slightly similar way, in the sense that we're both spoken about in a slightly othering sense. And it's, there's a... You can forget that we're the same people in a way. Millennials will become old people and face a lot of these problems. And millennials are also the children of these same people. Yeah. And there's not a neat divide between the two. In many ways, they're shared problems. And I think that's, if there's going to be solutions, that's how it will come, is looking at it as a societal, structural problem rather than, baby boomers have stolen the future of millennials, or like millennials are jealous of baby boomers' success. It's seeing it in its kind of, I don't know, it's holistic.
Just finally, did you see this story in The Guardian this week? The Resolution Foundation suggested giving £10,000 to every 25-year-old. It's hard to see how that would actually shift the dial. I mean, it'd be very nice in lots of ways, but it doesn't seem to me that would alter any structural positions at all.
Again, I completely agree with that. I think that when millennials are so baggaged with debt, I think the average student comes out with £50,000 of debt for a degree, which is the highest in the world, higher than America. Fees can waiver more in America, but the average rate is about half that for a student in America. £10,000, whether it's tied to housing or education, is nothing. And it's about what kind of a work is available to young people, what kind of possibility is there for growth within that career, and then what housing is available as well. So I think £10,000, although I love the sound of that, and as long as they bring it in before my 26th birthday, I don't think that will go anywhere near to addressing what is a very broad divide that cuts across society.
You weren't here when Lucy said that it's about addressing the whole issue with compassion. That's what you said at the beginning of the show.
Say compassion.
And
yeah.
Addressing it all with compassion. That's a good sentiment to leave it on. Samuel L., thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing and context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
This is the summer to expand your horizons. It's time to explore. But before you set foot out the door, set foot in the ultimate travel shoes from Allbirds. Like the breathable, silky smooth Tree Dasher, the responsive foam and extra grip of the Tree Runner, or the classic low-top look of the Tree Piper. Allbirds has a lightweight, ultra-packable shoe ready for whatever adventures you have planned. Boarding pass? Check. Passport? Check. The perfect travel shoe? Check. Find your perfect pair at Allbirds.com. That's Allbirds.com.
It is Mother's Day in America this week. Ruth Skerr tells us in her piece that it was started by a social activist, Anna Marie Jarvis, to reunite families divided by the Civil War. The tradition was carried on and promoted by her daughter, Anna, who then watched in horror as it grew into an exercise in commercialism to sell flowers, cards and sweets. Anna was arrested in 1925, protesting against the celebration she had campaigned for. Ruth is here to join us. Hello, Ruth. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm fine, Lucy. Hi.
Isn't that the way of the world, by the way?
Yeah, exactly, that yeah. You get arrested campaigning against. Yeah. Well, this is what I wanted to ask. Do you think this little story tells us something, you can say no, it doesn't, if you like, about public expectations of motherhood and the absolute impossibilities of living up to them?
Well, I think it's certainly a very poignant personal story because Anna was desperate to commemorate her mother and to carry on her work, and she set up this Mother's Day tradition, and then she wanted to control it and make it faithful to what she thought her mother deserved. And it's an incredibly personal story that gets projected onto a public commercial festival. And at the end of her life, she ends up in a nursing home, basically, which is partly paid for by the florist, who have made an enormous amount of money out of the commemoration of Mother's Day that she has then turned against. So I think what it shows us is the incredibly contorted and very complex feelings that the relationship evokes.
But is it not more, though, about just how the commercialization takes place in the modern world anyway? I mean, this doesn't seem to me to be a judgment about mothers or motherhood. This is just that if you find something that becomes marketable, it gets marketed.
Well, sure, because exactly the same happened with Easter, which, you know, becomes taken over, or Christmas, or all of those old religious festivals that become about spending money, effectively. But I still think that the attempt by this one woman to actually try and protest that and control it and make it something pure that was worthy of celebrating her ideal of motherhood is quite unusual.
Is there, you reviewed lots of three books, one of them is Jacqueline Rose's Mothers, An Essay on Love and Cruelty. Is the thesis of that that mothers are wrongly idealised? We expect too much of them and are therefore disappointed endlessly when they don't deliver the impossible.
That's exactly right. So she's trying to deconstruct all of the ideals and expectations that are projected onto the role, onto mothers. And she's also claiming that now, specifically, where we're living in times of more awareness of borders and a sort of a greater sense of excluding the foreign, mothers are targets for a lot of what she calls actually sadism.
Why is that?
Because they are simultaneously relied upon to be producing children and also blamed for putting the strain on social resources at the same time.
Yeah, and they're also blamed for if their children don't behave perfectly, which of course children
they
often don't.
Exactly.
As we all
yeah,
know.
They're expected to do the work of socialisation, to do a lot of education, to basically, you know, prepare their children for being citizens, for being adults.
But is that not happening less now, perhaps, where women are now, you know, 100 years ago, women's role in society was often restricted to motherhood, whereas you can make a case, can you now, that women are, of course, recognising every other aspect of society. So is the pressure on them less, or is it just actually an accumulation of pressures?
I think it's more, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's more to combine, isn't there? There's the expectation that you could both be, you know, a very powerful professional person, that you could also earn money, that you would also do all this work for bringing your child up on the side somehow.
I was wondering, can you tell us about how Jacqueline Rose, in her book, presents the problems of the lioness versus the inculcator of civic virtue?
Yes, that's wonderful. I mean, she's pointing out, she's actually going back to Virginia Woolf there, who is interested in the way in which people say they're focused upon children, but actually it's just their child. There's something very territorial and primitive about their relationship with their children, which of course, you know, defines their children against other people's children. But at the same time, as Jacqueline Rose is arguing in the book, there is also the expectation that you civilize your children and that you inculcate the virtues that society requires. So there's a conflict there at the very nature of the role as it's conceived.
Yeah. Presuming this is linked to the idea of tiger mums.
I think the tiger mums don't so much defend their young, as it were, do they? The tiger mums kind of
attack on their behalf.
But they also sort of attack the children because they sort of whip them into shape, don't they?
And I'm not sure the tiger mums are very interested in civic virtue either. They want their most competitive child and they want to win. I mean, we've all seen this at the school games.
Hang on a second, are we just accepting on faith that neither of you two are tiger mums?
I'm not sure we've
tested that. Does a tiger mum admit to being a tiger
also,
mum?
Also, can I say it's a very, very sexist term, because there's plenty of tiger dads.
Yeah.
I have seen plenty. You can see them. You know the old cliche about the dads on the touchline on Saturday morning?
Yeah. That's an accepted cliche. Why is there not a phrase for that?
Because society is sexist, Dick. That's why.
Yeah, but is that true? Is that a fair point there? You're sort of saying that's what we're sort of picking on. Yeah, it's kind of the Jacqueline Rose point. It's easy to pick on the mum.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, but perhaps you'd like to have come up with a term, Stig, for the phenomenon in the dad.
Tiger dad? that didn't take me very long.
Sounds very cuddly to me.
It does. It sounds quite nice.
Does it? You talk about a bit later on in the piece, and I'm interested in this, Ruth, about mothers in literature.
And not specific, there's mothers in literature, which you mentioned, like Medea being a sort of a classical one, but also the mothers of literary figures. That, how is the maternal revealed in literature? Do you think there's a sort of maternal influence on writers that they're constantly grappling with?
Well, I think writers, unsurprisingly, are extremely articulate when they choose to be about some of these very deep fundamental relations. So one of the examples that I touch on in the piece is Philip Larkin, unusually perhaps maybe the last of that generation to experience this, but I mean, sort of in receipt of at least one letter a week from his mother for a good 30 years. And so there's an incredible sense in that correspondence of her ongoing influence on him and the way in which that shapes his life, and then it comes through in his writing. And the other example that I included is Ian McEwan. It's an absolutely moving piece about, I mean, it begins at him saying, you know, I don't write like my mother, but for years I spoke like her. And then he goes on to analyse the effect that her language has had on his writing.
Which is odd, because there's a lot of absent mothers in his novels. I mean, very often the mother figure, if you think The Cement Garden, she dies. If you think in Atonement, there's that mother who always has migraines.
Yep.
The mother on Chesil Beach, one of them is
who's been hit by the train.
Hit by a train, and the other one is kind of allows effectively her husband to abuse Florence. Mothers in his novels aren't necessarily there, are they?
No, but I don't think we can go. I mean, I wouldn't want to suggest that you can go from, you know, the biographical straight to the fiction. I mean, I think what really interested me actually about his essay was the way he was talking about the influence on his language and on his writing, and the sense that she was, I mean, class is extremely important in McEwan, and he really does pin that down to the way in which she was very hesitant even to speak to people who she perceived to be of even just a slightly higher social standing than him.
I interviewed him yesterday, actually, on Front Row, and it got the bit got cut because it was a pre-recorded thing, but I was talking to him about children, and he was saying, as a kid growing up, working class Scottish family, there was never any affection showed towards children, really. There weren't many cuddles. Children are the centre of existence. And I think that's changed. Even I grew up in a very loving family, but the children fitted around the adults. Whereas I know categorically from my family, we fit around the needs of the children. You know, we're constantly making sure they're happy and doing stuff for them. And that does seem to be a shift, that children are becoming more prominent in culture, possibly than ever before.
But I think one of the really interesting things in the Jacqueline Rose book is to point out that that itself can be a real pressure on the child. If your parents are organising your lives around your happiness, and you're a normal adolescent who actually isn't that happy, or, you know, a young undergraduate or going in your early 20s and struggling to find your way, the sense that everything has been arranged around you being happy can be stressful in itself.
It's a good point. Well, it's not an entirely cheery piece, this, is it? Ruth's writing a long piece for Mother's Day in America. Oh, that'll be nice. That'll be a celebration of matters maternal.
Yeah, chocolate box.
Yeah. Just finally, then, are we to conclude that it's pretty wretched being a mother in modernity?
No.
No, I don't think so. I mean,
didn't sound so convincing, but go on.
I think it's a big improvement on being a mother earlier on, right? Very, very great. Well, for that, but I think the Rose book is challenging because it wants to say, actually, let's be careful about what we're expecting, and let's think about that from a fresh perspective.
Ruth Skerr, thank you very much indeed. Yeah, I do think that when I was talking to McEwan, it just occurred to me that there's been such a shift in child centrism.
I think that's true, and I'm sure that it just moves the pressure around, doesn't it? I think it is quite a modern thing, as Ruth said in her piece, and as you said, the idea of, here it's mothers, but really it's kind of parents, isn't it? It's wanting their child to be happy. I was reading in another book, I think it was Viv Albertine's book,
yeah,
that her mum was kind of going, everyone says they want their kids to be happy. She said, I want, her mum wanted her to be, what did she say, to lead an interesting life. And she wants her to be kind of fully alive in her own life. But nobody used to say, I just want you to be happy, darling. Yeah. No, it just wasn't the thing. That's not what people said. And I suppose in a way, I mean, it sounds simple. You don't want them to be unhappy.
No.
But maybe that is an added pressure. And maybe it's, you, I don't know about should. I don't believe in should in terms of parenting. But maybe one could say, I just want you to be you, or...
heartwarming. Yeah, just be you. That would go on a Mother's Day card. You're just a gross sentimentalist, Lucy.
I am, yeah, absolutely. Madeline Miller studied classics and taught Latin and Greek while writing her first novel, The Song of Achilles, which explores the relationship between that great warrior and Patroclus, who, as Homer tells us in the Iliad, accompanied him to Troy and was killed by Hector, setting off the events that led to the fall of Troy. Her second novel, Circe, deals with another Homeric character, who's also appeared in Ovid and other later classical stories, this time from the Odyssey. Circe is a mysterious witch goddess who turns Odysseus's men to swine, but then lives with him for a year and gives him invaluable help. Madeline Miller has inhabited Circe and given us her story, and she joined us to talk about witches, women, and who owns the narrative. Madeline, thank you for talking to us. Can I start with what sounds like a simple question, and I'm sure it isn't, and you'll tell me that it isn't. Is Circe the first witch?
Yes, she's the first witch in Western literature, although that's just in literature. I'm sure that, you know, there have been women who have been called witches for centuries, probably going all the way back as far as recorded history. As I started looking into what it meant to be a witch and exploring Circe and her witchcraft and how she relates to the history of witches, what I have come to really believe is that the word witch is what we call a woman who has more power than we think she should have. So I think that is eternal, because there have always been powerful women and always been people telling them that they can't have that power.
Yes, and but she is powerful. Well, she's powerful in all sorts of ways, isn't she? But one of the sources of her power comes from not magic. So, well, it is magic, but it's also of her own making. It doesn't just come to her from the sky. She has to work at it. She works out how to use it, and she uses herbs, and she does it herself, as it were.
Yes, and that was one of the things that I loved about her witchcraft, is that, you know, she's born a goddess, so she has some very, very minor divine powers. She's a nymph, so she's the lowest of the low in the ancient Greek hierarchy, barely really any power there. But her witchcraft is very powerful, and it's all things that she does herself. She learns how to do. So it's the skill with the herbs, as you said, with poisons. She has kind of an ability with animals as well. And I loved the fact that it was something that she created. She wills into being. It's not something she's born with. It's something that she chooses to make.
Sorry. Yeah. And I was also struck by the fact that she has to work quite hard at it. And she gets it wrong. I mean, in the beginning, she gets it wrong. She has to work it out. The stuff doesn't work. It becomes a profession.
Yes, exactly. One of the fascinating details that Homer gives us about Circe in the Odyssey is that she's the dread goddess, or the terrifying goddess, who speaks like a mortal. And that was a fascinating way in for me, because what it implied to me is that she sort of has one foot in the world of the gods and one foot in the world of humanity. And so I was interested in that conflict, and I think she spends a lot of the book kind of negotiating what does it mean to be a god and what does it mean to be human or immortal. And I think that hard work is actually one of the great virtues that she learns from humanity. Gods, of course, particularly the Greek gods, don't have to work for anything. Everything they want just comes at a snap. And, you know, they're very selfish and very self-involved, and they want what they want when they want it immediately. They're a little bit like toddlers, actually. And she instead goes this other route, where she really hones a craft, and she comes to feel that there is real value and virtue in working at something and failing and trying again and trying again.
And that's just one of the ways that she differentiates herself from from the other gods, it seems. Now, your first book, The Song of Achilles, is about one of the most famous heroes of all, and we all think we know all about him. And it is necessarily a very male story. It's just full of blokes fighting and just doing all sorts of things. And it reminded me of Mary Renault's work quite a lot, which I mean as a great, great compliment, because she's wonderful, I think. Good. And I suppose the main, not the only female figure, but the main female figure there was Achilles' mother, Thetis, who was also a nymph. Was it, I'm just wondering whether it was a conscious decision to focus on a woman this time, or did it come because you were interested in nymphs, because you were writing about Thetis, or was it something else?
It was some of both. I absolutely think that working with the character of Thetis, who was one of my favorite characters to write and to explore, even though she's the antagonist for much of the book, I never saw her as a villain at all. I actually found her very sympathetic. And sort of she flows right into Circe because they are both nymphs. They're both these lesser goddesses. And those lesser goddesses in ancient Greek myth were pretty much, they were pawns or they were prey. And, you know, even though they had this divine power, they weren't really able to control their own destiny. They were constantly being, you know, abused or passed around. And Thetis spends the entire novel working so hard to save her son's life, and she can't. She just can't. And so I wanted to look at that from sort of a similar perspective, but with this added witchcraft element. And very, very deliberately, I wanted to give voice to a female character. You know, when you've been studying these texts for a long time and working with them, of course, you can't help but notice that all the composers and writers of these wonderful ancient texts, with very few exceptions, are men, and the protagonists are often men as well. And so I knew when it came time for the second novel, I really wanted to give voice to a woman, and there was never any question. It was always Circe.
That was Madeline Miller joining us to talk about her novel Circe, and you can hear the whole of this interview as an accompanying podcast on our feed.
Isn't everyone lucky?
They'll be the judge of that.
Indeed they will. That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Samuel Earle, Madeline Miller and Ruth Sker. Thank you, Lucy.
Thank you for having me.
Did you enjoy yourself?
Of course.
Motherhood, witches and millennials.
All of it. Stig, are you going to mention all the exciting things we're doing?
Oh, God, yeah. Well, you do your bit. You're doing the Bath Literary Festival.
Yes, so Thea and I are doing what is called a live podcast.
Wait, and what that means?
Our producer told me that's an oxymoron, but we're doing a lovely event.
Yes. Which will produce as a podcast.
Yes, yeah. Exactly, we will. And we'll be talking to Robert Webb, the actor and comedian and writer who wrote the wonderful How Not to Be a Boy.
Which you actually have read.
I really have read it. I think,
genuinely.
Yep.
Yeah.
And the wonderful Margaret Drabble, who has written millions of wonderful books.
Which you also have read.
Yes, I certainly have. And so we'll be talking to
when
them in Bath on May the 24th. Yep.
And the tier list is going to be at the Hay Festival, which I'm going to. I've got an event talking about my book, which I've not mentioned, really, on
no,
this podcast.
No, you haven't. I should ask you about your book. How is your book?
It's making me filled with dread when I think about it. But it's called How Britain Really Works. I'm doing an event at Hay, and I'm also interviewing Ian McEwan again. I've interviewed him this week to talk about adaptations and writing. And I'm introducing a lecture by Simon Sharma. And if you go to the Hay Festival, you can get a free copy of the paper. It will be in the Friends Cafe. Thea's doing an event as well. So just come on and say hello to us in Bath. And then Hay, which is basically the end of May, which is an unintentional rhyme.
Yep.
For you. Well, thank you very much, Lucy. Do subscribe to the TLS if you are listening. It's chock full of goodies this week, including stuff on Dante, Neruda and Debussy. You're more of a Debussy person, I'd say, of those three.
I'd say Debussy every time.
I'd say Dante. We are not entirely flattering about Neruda.
Well, he didn't always
get it right.
Yes, that's one way of putting it.
Indeed. Next week, the paper's got lots of science in it, which terrifies me to my very humanities-driven soul. So do come back and watch me struggle. Until then, from Lucy and from me, goodbye.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.